This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Brothers, before I begin, I want to say something about Sheikh Abdul Idris, whom I love so much. You know, he's from Sudan. And I learned something about the brothers from Sudan. They never ever put sugar in their coffee. It's true. They put coffee in their sugar. I just want to say this. They love sweets. And he's a very sweet man. Tonight, brothers and sisters, I want to do two things. Two suggestions. The first one is obvious. You must read the Quran every day. The Prophet said the best of you those who read the Quran and teach it. Read the Quran every day and read the words of our beloved Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, and we will have a better understanding. The Quran is relevant. It deals with issues of today. The second thing I want to recommend, you must know the laws of the land in which you live. You must. Especially the Constitution of the United States of America. What is the difference between the Quran and the Constitution? You tell me, what is the difference between the Quran and the Constitution? What is the difference? But one is man-made, the Constitution. Our founding fathers never claimed it to be divine. Proof of it, they have in the Constitution a provision to make changes. So since the time of the beginning of the Constitution until now, there have been 27 amendments to the Constitution of the United States of America. We never claimed that the Union was perfect. We, the people of the United States, in order to make a more perfect Union, to make it more perfect, and the greatness of our Constitution is that it can always change as good. My mother gave me some advice. She said, son, people are people. The very nature of human beings is that sometimes we're good, sometimes we're bad. Our Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, said, Inna ana bashar. I am only a human being. We are not divine, we are not angels, we are human beings. Now, I told my friends jokingly, Reverend, that if Donald Trump becomes the president of the United States of America, I'm getting my passport and I'm going to a different country. Keep going to Canada. I was like, they're joking, right? Found out that everybody's saying the same thing. And I can give you at least 1,000 reasons. Let me give you one. In July, Donald Trump was asked, have you ever asked God for forgiveness? He hesitated a long time and said, that's a difficult question. He said, I hope that I would never do anything that I would have to ask God forgiveness. Our Prophet, Reverend, said, Wallahi, inni astaghfirullah wa atubu ilayhi fil yawm akthar min 70 maratan. He said, I ask Allah's forgiveness every day more than 70 times a day. We are human beings. And he said that if I become president, I'm going to do this. I'm going to change everything that Obama has said, people are people, which comes to my topic today. I feel very generous today. I want to give away some money. Anyone here needs money, can use money? I'm prepared right now to give $1,000 out of the Reverend's pocket. For anyone who can answer this question, racism isn't the same as institutionalized racism. I would argue that the first racist was Shaitan the devil. When Allah says, "Ma mana'aka illa tasjuda idh amartuka," قال أنا خير منه خلقتني من نار وخلقته من طين. Why didn't you bow down when I ordered you? He said, I'm better than Adam. You created me of fire, and him you created of mud or clay. I'm better. Why? Because of your spirituality, your intellect? What? No, I'm better because of my creation. So he's the first racist. When you have a racist, it's bad. I'll give you one example. Have you ever heard of Medgar Evers? Medgar Evers was a civil rights worker. When he was a young man in high school, he used to have to walk to school 12 miles a day. And he said that when he walked to school, the children in the white children in the buses used to throw things at them, walking to school, trying to get an education. And they did it because of their racism. But that isn't a major problem. Racism, thinking yourself better than someone else based upon your color, that's a problem, but that isn't the real problem. The real problem is institutionalized racism. It's in the very institution. It's in the penal, it's in the educational system, housing, everything in law, everything. It raises its ugly head. I want to give you one example. Reverend, you know that this is the 50th year anniversary of the famous Civil Rights Bill of Voting Rights Act of 1965. 50 years ago is a very important point. Institutionalized racism? Black people, in order to vote in many places of the South, had to take a literacy test. So I want one person who would like to get $1,000 come up. And I want you to answer one of the questions that were asked to black people in the 60s. And if you get it right, Allah, he will give you $1,000. Anyone volunteer? Come, Jay. No, you, no, young, come. Yeah, gonna get $1,000. Well, he happy, look at him. Boy, now I'm gonna give you some money. Okay, I'll give it to you. I promise you, get it right. Take the mic. Answer this question and you have $1,000. First, I want to ask you, do you want cash or check? Either. Okay, put the mic to you. Okay. Question. How many bubbles in a bar of soap? That was on the test.
I say zero.
Zero. Very good. Bye-bye. Sorry. Anyone else volunteer? One more question, a different question. Sheikh, you don't need $1,000? One more? Come on, man! This looks like an intelligent man. He can answer this simple question. And this one is easy, Sheikh, really, relatively speaking.
Have you ever heard of the Constitution of the United States of America?
Yes, I have.
Excellent. Now recite it by heart.
I can't.
Okay, bye-bye.
That's institutionalized racism. In 1963, a place called Dallas, city, what state was that? Dallas County. Alabama. The population of Dallas was 57% African Americans. Of the 15,000 black men and women who was eligible to vote, only 130 actually was registered to vote because of all of the intimidation, et cetera, et cetera. My advice to us, we must use the law, know the law of the land, and use it to our advantage. Like Martin Luther King Jr. did, like Malcolm did, et cetera. Two things I'm going to say, and then I'm finished. I hand it over to our illustrious Reverend. Two things. The turning point of the Civil Rights Movement, I was there, I lived it, happened, in my opinion, March 7th, 1965. It's not often that I recommend you to watch a movie. I'm going to recommend two movies today for you to go see. The first one is called Selma. I'm sorry. If you didn't see it, you need to watch it. Very accurate, maybe a point here and there. It's not 100% accurate, but very, very accurate. The famous march from Selma, Alabama to the capital, Montgomery. In March 7th, 600 people set out to march from Selma to Montgomery. But the police stopped them on a Sunday and beat them. It's called Bloody Sunday. And what they didn't know is that while the police were beating these unarmed protesters, JF Kennedy said, "Those who will make peaceful revolution impossible will make violent revolution inevitable." And the beautiful thing about our religion, our nation, we have the right to protest. What happened is that night at 9 o'clock, there was a movie being shown called The Judgment at Nuremberg. 48 million Americans were watching, and they interrupted that program to show the protests that had taken place and all those black people that were brutalized by the police. And the nation saw it and they were outraged. And everybody began to talk about it and say that this can't be done. 2 days later, March 9th, was another march. And not only were black people there, but white people there, reverends and rabbis, Jewish rabbis were there. And it had grown from 600 people to 2,500 people. And they got together and they began the march from Selma to Montgomery. But what happened is that Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and the organizers stopped and turned around. It's called Turnaround Tuesday. And the reason that they turned around is because they didn't have the legal right to proceed, right? 7th, the 9th. After the federal judge lifted the injunction, gave them a right to march, when they marched this time, when they got to Montgomery, Alabama, they were 25,000 people. And in that year, President Johnson signed the famous Voting Rights Act of 1965. It changed everything. This is my advice. I'm going to give you one example. What about Muslims? Look what we face. Islamophobia. Look at that, what they do to us. I'm saying learn from African Americans. Whatever we do must be nonviolent. The only way that we will succeed in this country is that it must be nonviolent. Now I'm going to close. I know there's a couple of lawyers here. I saw some of them in my old session. How many lawyers will be there? I need someone here. Just tell me, you don't need word for word, but just tell me, make us understand the First Amendment. Can anyone do that? Can someone tell me about the First Amendment?
So the First Amendment was actually had five freedoms that people thought that they wouldn't be able to have unless they would because they wanted a Bill of Rights that they really needed, otherwise they thought that they would screw them over.
Number one,
freedom of religion.
Good. You have the freedom of religion. You can practice your faith. You don't have to hide it. You have the right to practice your faith. Number one. Number two.
Freedom of speech.
Freedom of speech. You can talk about your religion. No one can stop you from practicing and talking about your faith. Number three.
Freedom of assembly.
Freedom of?
Assembly.
Yeah, hold that one. Hold that one, guys.
Well, this one's freedom of addition.
Hold that one.
Freedom of press.
You have the right to publicize whatever you want. You have the right. You can write a book about Islam. You have the right. You can write a newspaper. You have that right. You are a Muslim, you are an American, and you have that right. Don't you ever give it up. That's your right. You got it even right. Now, last one. Assembly.
Assembly.
Is petition?
No, that's not an assembly.
Okay, assembly.
I love this young man. I love you. You can protest. You have the right to protest. Abdul Malik Mujahid mentioned yesterday about 60 million refugees. But what he didn't say is that 70% of the refugees of the world are Muslims. We have here the right to assemble. And the last one, he's going to tell us the last one. Go ahead.
Petition.
All right. Okay, that's it.
So you're allowed to basically, you're allowed to petition, you're allowed to have a...
Thank you, did a wonderful job. Thank you so much. And even the last one. We have the right to petition our government for redress of grievances. I'm going to give you one case. You have to know the Constitution. You have to know the land, the law of the land. I'm going to give you one example, then I close. In a place called Bridgewater, New Jersey, not far from my home, New York City, that area have 17 churches, a Catholic convent, a Jewish synagogue, two Hindu temples, and a Sikh temple, but not one masjid. So the Muslims in that area decided that they wanted to build a masjid. And there was some property on 10 acres of land that they wanted to use for a masjid. So in that area, you could build religious houses of worship. And they went to the city council to apply. The city council changed the law. The people said, we don't want Muslims here. Sounds like we don't want black people here. It's the same thing. And the city council caved in and changed the law.
What did the Muslims do? They petitioned the government, the federal government. And guess what? It was a settlement.
So they said, okay, we don't want you to have this land. The Muslims said, okay. So they gave them a better land, 15 acres.
And then they won some money. You know how much money we won? $7,750,000. The right to petition the government.
You have that right? Those African Americans, they paid the price. We should learn from them. By the way, I was discriminated against because I was black, and now I'm discriminated because I'm Muslim. So I have a double whammy. But that's all right. Alhamdulillah. As-salamu alaykum.
I'd like to pick up where he left off. The Voting Rights Act is under attack. There is a malicious attempt by the right in our country to pull back the Voting Rights Act, to pull back all of the gains of the Civil Rights Movement. So it's incumbent upon us not only to know that history, but to recognize that with social justice, with any progress, every step forward is accompanied by a step backwards. And so it's going to be upon us in going forth from this convention to make sure that the Voting Rights Act doesn't get fully stripped in Michigan and across the country. I'd like to start myself talking a little bit more about my own personal story, because I want you to know how I came to have this be such a passion for myself. The kind of work that I do in trying to battle racism and in trying to now work with the Muslim community against Islamophobia. I was born in the city of Detroit. I had two uncles who were both Detroit City firemen. Unfortunately, my father passed away when I was just 2 years old. I'm the youngest of five. And in Detroit, what happened in the city of Detroit in 1967? Anybody know what happened in the city of Detroit?
The riots.
Okay. So I was born in 1966. So as I'm growing up with two firemen uncles, we would spend time around the holiday. We're about to celebrate Thanksgiving, and there would be family discussions. And they would look at my mother, who is now a widow with five children, and say, Gail, that's my mother's name, Gail, you need to get those kids out of the city of Detroit. No explanation other than the fear of someone looking different. On my block, there was a house being built next to us. And I moved out of Detroit when I was 6 years old. So the house that was going up next to us was being built, and it was a fine house, it was a beautiful house, but the suspicion was a black family was going to be moving into that house. So the trumpet started to get blown a little hard to get out. And we were forced, basically by fear, to move out. And my grandmother, my mother's mother, had a wonderful home in the country, a very sedate, but incredibly racist community. And as I grew up there, we had to deal with the situation of a friend of mine in the seventh grade. He moves up to the area from Indiana. His father's a minister, and he's got two adopted children. And one of the adopted children is a young man about 7 years old. He happens to be black. The sister was six. She happened to be black. In a community that did not welcome and accept people of color. When I went to the Detroit Zoo as on a field trip, as often kids will do, you get in a bus, you go on a field trip. The city of Detroit's zoo isn't in the city of Detroit, it's in Royal Oak. But as you're there was a bus of African American children. And all of my classmates were looking at the children from that other bus and talking down to them simply because of their color. So one episode after the other is part of my kind of upbringing of why this is incredibly wrong. And so for me to see the same kind of stuff happen to Muslims, to anybody that's different in any way, is an unbelievable affront to my values and my conscience. Because you need to recognize that race is a construct. It's a social construct to keep control over a person. You didn't mention how were slaves counted in 3/5. African Americans were counted as 3/5 of a human being in the beginning. 3/5. All the way through history, African Americans have been dehumanized. See, when you treat somebody as if they're different than you because of whatever, color, anything that you choose, part of what you do when you treat someone different is you all of a sudden make them other. And if you're in power and they have less power, then you're dehumanizing. They're making them somewhat less than human. You're making them 3/5 of a human being. Unconsciously, right? How does our media portray Muslims today? As what? Terrorists. Terrorists. Huh. What about Hollywood? What does it do to Arabs? Pardon? Villains, right? Villains, harems, everything else, right? Dehumanizing people to keep them under. Now what we have, all of this takes place to make us the new boogeyman. Right? You know what I mean by boogeyman? What's the boogeyman? Anybody, what's a boogeyman? What's the boogeyman?
Some scary person.
The boogeyman is what you scare, what you're afraid of, what's underneath your bed when you're a kid, when you turn off the lights and you're afraid of the dark. You're afraid of the boogeyman because you don't know who that is. That's what our country is continuing to do with Muslims. You are, in our narrative, the new boogeyman. We came out of a world construct where the Cold War, which basically legitimized how we did everything that we did in the world in terms of foreign policy. We could shift our alliances because we were against the evil empire, which was the Soviet Union. That's how we did all of our decisions to keep the engine of our army going. We've replaced communism with Islamophobia. Post 9/11, everything that happens in the world tends to pit. Look what happens. What do we have coming up as a national election in 2016? Pay attention to what happens as we get closer to that election. Do you think Homeland Security with the colors? Yeah. The colors will go up, right? Because what happened with post 9/11? We as a people, all of us, started giving up our rights. Right? Muslims lost all their rights that they had because you didn't really have rights. But in terms of what was going on in Guantanamo and other places like that, you could be held without any cause, just some suspicion. Now we have terrorist lists, right? Mm-hmm. But half of Dearborn was on the terrorist list, wasn't it? Something like that. That's what our country has done when you dehumanize another person, when you make them less. And that's what the institutional racism, they gave the examples about what the voting are all about, is that all of a sudden the fear of other, of that other person, justifies that they're somehow less than human, and that allows the ethos, the values, the programs, the policies, everything that happens around the way the world works is constructed by those images. And it affects everything. So bring this right to the present. In Macomb County, guess who knows where Macomb County is in the room, so I can give a little, okay, some of you. If you drive northeast from where we're at Cobo Hall and you cross 8 Mile, you're in Macomb County. There's 875,000 residents in Macomb, so it's bigger than, I think, 8 or 9 states in the country. How many languages do you think are spoken in Macomb County? In the schools? Yeah, anybody? 30? 8, keep going up, 10, no, you have to go up above 30, keep going, 50, keep going, how many? 100. 100 languages are spoken in our school district right now. That means there's a lot of people that don't look like me, right? So I'm asked to be on a panel for the school district for the Macomb County. It's called the Intermediate School District. It deals with all of the special education programs for the county, but it also is a resource for every school district in the county. There's 21 school districts. So all of their curriculum, all of what they do, kind of filters through the MISD, is what they call it. So they put together an advisory committee to do a strategic plan. There's 100 languages spoken. There's, in Sterling Heights alone, 1 out of 4 people there is born from a different homeland, foreign-born, 1 out of 4. And I look around the room at this advisory committee. Guess what I saw? Anybody have an idea?
White?
Very white. There was one African American sister there.
It wasn't a slap mistake.
She was staff. And there was one Chaldean sister. That was it. Out of the entire group of people. And they're doing a strategic plan. That's institutional racism. How can you address the gap that's in there that's basically because of racism between black and white and test and everything else if you don't have anybody at the table who's setting the plan for how you're going to go about doing education for the next 10 years? That's what it's all about. And so to echo what the Imam said, you have to know your history. You have to know that the plight of African Americans is tied with your plight as Muslims.
Absolutely.
But it's bigger than that. It's not just blacks and Muslims. Dr. King said, an injustice anywhere is an injustice everywhere. Which means, when that Sikh temple is vandalized, you need to show up. When those kids are mistreated because they're Hispanic, you need to show up. When some bozo like Donald Trump gets on the television and says you're an illegal alien, no human being's illegal. You're a human being, right? We have to bond together as one. And the only way we can do that is if someone's problem becomes our problem. And then it's incumbent upon you to reach out to partners like myself and others in hopes that together we can find voice to petition the government for everybody. Assalamu alaikum.